This is John Weir Perry, Healing Through Visionary Experience. This is May 4th, 1990, tape 1 of 2.
Welcome to this evening's talk tonight on visionary states. The Jungian Society of Seattle warmly welcomes you all. And I have a few announcements for future programs. Jungian Synchronicity in Astrological Signs, a lecture by Alice O. Howell, is going to be offered May 29th at 7:30 p.m. in room 210 of Kane Hall, which I believe this is the same room. We're going to be offering some summer programs as well, and look in your mailbox soon for our newsletter for summer. May 23rd, we have our annual meeting for the election of the board of directors for the Jungian Society, and we're also offering the Splendor Solis, which is a series of alchemical paintings that are very profound and breathtaking to see, and you're all invited to that. Members are welcome. Become a member and see the Splendor Solis. The Jungian Society is pleased to present Dr. John Weir Perry from the Bay Area. Dr. Perry has dedicated much of his life and his work to the healing possibilities of the unconscious and the psyche. Through a Rockefeller grant in 1947, he attended the Jungian Institute in Zurich, which actually was the very first year of the training program there. And he worked in his own analysis with Dr. Meyer and Tony Wolf, and had private meetings with Dr. Jung as well. In 1973, he developed a very special, unique program called Diabasis. Diabasis is Greek for crossing over. And it was designed as a place for people undergoing deep psychological change and first-time psychotic break as an alternative to the medical model in which an individual can go through a healing process, a death and renewal process. And this was something that was very rare. Maybe thousands of years ago we may have attempted it, but it was something very, very rare. And he had to buck up against a tremendous resistance to pull this off, which he was able to do. Unfortunately, Diabasis, because of funding in the 70s, had to close. But the ideas for this program are still there, and the potentials are enormous in working in this type of way with people undergoing such a profound psychological transformation. He just returned a month ago from delivering a paper on visionary states at the John Hopkins Medical School, and he was very warmly received there. This was just a month ago. He's recently retired from his medical practice, and he's now consulting, and I'd like to give a warm welcome to Dr. John Weir Perry.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you again for that introduction. Let's see if I got this right. There we go. What I'm going to do this evening is spend the first hour asking a question. It'll take about the full time to ask the question, I think. And I hope then in the second hour we can all try to come up with some answers to it. It's quite complex. It concerns, of course, visionary states. By this, I think you understand what we mean. It's altered states of consciousness that are prolonged, anything from days to weeks. Oddly enough, the characteristic time for the great famous visionary states in history have been 6 weeks. You recognize that as 40 days. I've seen that in a good many psychotic people, too, that... In about 6 weeks' time, without any medication, they the psyche is kind of done what it wants to do and releases the individual to be free again to get on with life. This may be at times, for some people, overwhelming, of course. The lucky person is the one who is so geared and has so much energy and consciousness and so much capacity to process this that they can take this overwhelming kind of experience and assimilate it and grow by it and be able to be creative with it. Some are not so fortunate. For us, when we have those people in psychotherapy, we at least have a chance to learn a great deal because we can see them every day, watch how this thing progresses. Everything's out in the open all at once. And in a way, it's an ideal way to get a picture of what goes on in the psyche when it's dealing with turmoil and profound change like this. So that's what I'm going to be talking about this evening. There was, for instance, a young man of 33 at San Francisco General Hospital when I was working for that decade during the 50s, volunteering time on their wards. And this was very disturbed, very psychotic, 33-year-old man who was in solitary, called seclusion, and four-point restraints. No, but restraints anyway, not four-point. But very withdrawn, uncommunicative, mute. And when I met him, I sat on the corner of the bed and asked him what's going on, you know, would he like to talk about that? And he was still mute, but there were tiles right next to the bed, and on the square tiles, he drew the square and across it and a little circle in the middle and pointed to it. I said, yeah, that's a place that where a lot of things seem to go on, isn't it? This look of astonishment came across his face. He didn't know how anybody could possibly know that that's what he was having in mind. So we formed instantly this kind of working relation, as it turned out. When I came in next time, he was beginning to talk. He was on the ward, and 2 days later. And we could get an impression of what all this was at the center. And what it was a journey through, I'll come back to it a little later, journey through hell and purgatory and heaven, and all represented in diagrams, quite simply, but still, for him, very absorbing. And always emphasizing in triangles and squares and a pentagram that the center was the place that he was taking this cosmic journey. It wound up in a few days' time with a diagram that showed in the circle an upper circle and or upper point and lower one with a canal going between them. And he said, the upper end of that, of course, is the head, and the lower end is the heart. And as he talked about that, it turned out to be a vocational question. Now, this is almost the first occasion on which he connected back with re-entry, so to speak. You know, he was coming back to questions about this world, ordinary reality. He said, I really don't know whether to go the way of the head, which would be to take orders and be a priest. He was a Catholic. And be a father in that sense, or to go the way of the heart, which would be to be a father in the other sense, paterfamilias, marry, have a family, and be an engineer, which was indeed his education. So that I find is a very typical kind of experience, that you go on this long cosmic journey in different levels, and as they circle around back, there are very immediate questions that are on their mind that I think one would not get to otherwise. This is nature's own way of bringing up things in the acute episode that are most urgent. Textbooks tell you there's no such thing as doing psychotherapy during the episode. We found a diabesis exactly the opposite. It's the ideal time to do deep psychotherapeutic work because everything's there. It tumbles out all about the parents and early infancy and childhood and reenacting it all. Everything's happening. And they can work with it. Now, that very humble journey of his had none of the grandeur of Dante's, let's say. It was Dante-like. None of that wonderful poetic enrichment and elaboration and passionate handling. And a very inspired and very gifted individual. But the ground plan is the same. It is the same journey, essentially. In this case, quite stark, but still effective. He even had Beatrice-like ladies in his imagery, which meant in his life as well. And there was one who was indeed his, named Cora, by the way, the heart, who was his inspiration for most of his spiritual life. And then on a higher level, Our Lady of Fatima was the queen of his universe, so to speak. And in that way, it was Dantesque, I think. His process was a healing one. After a number of weeks, he was able to go out, as these people usually do. The more crazy, the more disturbed, the more productive the unconscious is, the more overwhelming it is, the better these people do. The ones who don't do so well are the kind of quiet, meek, unassertive ones who don't have a lot going on inside. Does my voice carry? Not somewhere else? I'll turn it up a little here to see if it can do better. Now, this psychotic visionary state most usually has an aim. And here I'm speaking of the first episode particularly. Later on, it gets to be different in time. The ideation of the beginning, as you know, is totally confusing. There's fragmentation at the ego level, fragmentation at the level of the complexes, personal unconscious. And all the energy is back in the deep psyche. And along with that shift of energy, the sense of reality follows that same pattern, and the outside world isn't very real for somebody in that state. It's indifferent. But the real world that they're living in is not the usual one at all. It's a myth world full of elaborate imagery, very rapidly moving, commanding of their attention. And once you get past the fragmentation, things are different. Once a member of the staff connects with such an individual and listens and responds at least feelingly, you don't have to interpret. That makes a whale of a difference to somebody in that space. They don't feel any longer so isolated. And the result is that instead of the fragmentation, suddenly things begin to cohere. And it becomes a process that is more or less orderly. It's funny to speak of it as orderly because it tumbles around a good deal. But still, it moves, and it has a direction and an outcome. So that fragmentation, I think, is an artifact of the cultural bias and the psychiatric bias, that they're isolated, alone with this, and it just goes off like a bomb inside. Now, I'll just go a little bit more into his content. I'm sure there's some of you who never heard this before, and I apologize to the ones who have. But he's at a center, that cosmic center going up and down the three levels. I'm going to abbreviate if you don't mind. He's preoccupied with death, saying, people are going to poison me, go ahead, kill me, kill me. And at other times he'd say he's on the way of the cross toward the crucifixion. Now, he, beginnings, time is going backward for him. He even drew a picture of time going backward. He had a clock in this diagram, the sun at the center, and it goes 3, 6, 9. And he calls it back a clock. That's the whole cosmos for him, it's going backward. And indeed, that is the habitual thing, that these people are taken back to the beginning of time and witness the creation very often. Often they go back to the Garden of Eden. Then he's in the midst of a mortal combat, a world combat, which I'll call the cosmic conflict, where the forces of the church and of Christ are opposed to the work of the devil. And this, on the more terrestrial plane, is Our Lady of Fatima against the communists. This was in the 1950s. That was a very prevalent kind of preoccupation of people at that time, that this world was divided into two halves, one light, one dark, one good, one evil. Luckily, we're maybe emerging from that, get a new world image for a change. But this kind of cosmic conflict of gigantic cosmic forces is typical. And then he has this apotheosis, which is often the delusion of grandeur, so to speak, where he's identified with some extraordinary figure. For him, it was a messianic calling. He also thought of himself as the second coming, no less. I should say, when you listen to content like this, if you're not used to it, it does sound pretty preposterous. Everything is too much, and they claim too much of themselves. And it isn't that inflation is so much the trouble, it's the result, but it isn't really the fault. But it's the fault is this tendency universally, the tendency to identify with almost any image that comes up. So one moment to be the hero of this, or another moment the messiah of that, or he'll be Christ, he'll be newborn, or whatever. Women are the Virgin Mary, or the goddess, or the queen. They just identify with what image comes across the mental stage. If it weren't for that, it would sound much more like a dream. It would sound much more natural. And if you relate to these as images that are passing by and doing their work, it makes perfectly good sense. So, in that sense, there's a sacred marriage in which he beholds the Immaculate Conception. He looks up rather transfixed and sees this thing happening in the sky. And then he had a good deal of preoccupation with Cora and a sister figure, Claire de Lune, Cora, the Sacred Heart, that kind of thing. The names were played with quite a lot. But that idea of marriage was always on that very elevated plane. No ordinary marriage. Then a new birth theme that kept coming. He wanted to have babies, he said, but he drew the picture of an egg as a symbol of this new birth. And the final one really was that his journey through hell and purgatory and heaven were 3 degrees of initiation. The 4th degree of initiation was the new birth for him. And that completed the unconscious task. He envisioned the new society, I've left something out here. So go in here. The opposite. He's very scared of being changed to the other sex. That's universal. But there's a concept of a new society under the sodality of Our Lady Fatima for him. That would be a world mission. The whole world would be changed by this. And again, he draws the picture of it as a great rosary with a cross down below and four parts of the world in this world mission. And there are four different continents, four colors, four creeds, four races. That's the picture of the resolved end of the process. And about that time, he's able to let it go. Now, I schematize it almost too much. You know, it makes it look like an entity, a sort of a program. It comes, in fact, in a, something of a turmoil. It's all out of sequence always, and the images come tumbling by, and they don't hang around very long. But you can work a lot with them when they are there, and it is a rather regularly recurring set of concerns, components of the process. It took me some years, about six or seven years, before I knew what this is all about. I didn't understand what kind of mythology, what kind of ritual is behind this thing. It didn't seem to hang together until I picked up Mircea Eliade's book on Myth of the Eternal Return, and it was like a bolt of lightning for me. It was, there it was, this whole program, indeed, which was a summary of the myth and ritual of the ancient Near East. Renewal rites of kingship, festivals of New Year, which were to renew the person of the king and the state of the whole kingdom and the cosmos. It's a universal process, going back to the beginning of time and following just this. The king goes through death, ritually speaking, and descends into the underworld and is rescued by a hero in a conflict of the forces of life against the forces of death. And then he comes back, he's victorious and celebrated as victor and hero, and the whole city rejoices where there had been in lamentations during the death phase. And so then after that, on top of the ziggurat, the stepped pyramid at the center of the city, would be a sacred marriage in which the king would unite with the priestess or somebody representing the goddess in a sacred marriage to rejuvenate the land and reinvigorate the forces of nature. The program is so faithfully followed, it really was hard for me to believe. I've also raised questions about how this can be. You know, that particular sequence one does not see, at least I haven't been able to find it before that time. This happened in the Bronze Age, beginning of cities and urban culture, which is a great transformation of the world at that time, of society, a very bewildering time. And these myths and rituals to rejuvenate were really to try to bring meaningfulness and order into this turbulent new change that was going on at that time. Since there was not there before, we could conclude that this was a new phenomenon in human nature that has been there ever since. That's 5,000 years ago. There had never been large-scale warfare before, no armies, no organized colonies. All these were brand new things. And this kind of kingship was brand new, this kind of rule. So all these are phenomena of a great transformation of culture at that time. And we must have to conclude, maybe, if you like linear time and all that kind of thing still, that this appeared de novo, that new conditions of society and culture produced new myths, and they've been there ever since. If you like to think of archetypes as being more cosmic than that, then you'd have to say that 5,000 years ago is when people tuned into those and brought them out into ritual expression. Take your choice. For the individuals, as a personal experience, this is most certainly a self-healing process. It's a self-organizing, self-reorganizing effort on the part of the psyche, proceeding in its own idioms, its own manner, with its own methods and goal, its own devices for change. And all we can do is relate to it and expectantly watch to see what's going to be next, not passively, actively following it together with the person. When you do that, you have the feeling both persons together are watching this drama going on. And it means everything to that person to have somebody there receiving it and not doing it in isolation. That attendance, you've heard of that word before, therapeia, therapy, therapeia in Greek, means attending upon the gods. Very good description of what therapy was supposed to have been, and we forget it. But attending, serving it, waiting upon it, is a thing that works in this kind of process. So, of course, as you know, what's happening in this is a new self is being processed. It's in preparation during this whole procedure. And what that means in everyday terms, as far as I'm concerned, is a new system, a new structure of values, meanings, new world outlook, and most of all, probably a new design of life, new lifestyle. No small order. And during the process, when it's all confused, values are up for grabs, and meanings are, there are lots of alternative meanings that come by, and it's as if all the possibilities are put forward by the psyche, and the individual has to feel out what is really waiting there for him or her. And a second very important part of it is this image of a new society. Everybody has that, and everybody expresses it in terms of a society of people who are caring, tolerant, kindly, loving. And you get the impression that really the healing thing in this process is the capacity to love in that way. Not sentimentally, but just caringly, being able to give and receive feelings and relate meaningfully. So that they sound much like each other. This image of how the world's going to be after the great messianic program gets going, it's always that, every time. I've not heard other kinds. The very important part of that whole picture of a messianic program is, of course, that it is to be taken strictly symbolically. And that's what's, for many patients, very hard to do. To know that this is going on in their inner world and not something that's outside the window there. It has reference then to one's own inner subjective culture in the making. That's what the new society really is. It's one's own subjective culture, heretofore undiscovered. They're outgrowing the one the family gave them, and with the new self comes this new culture form. So we find that when the world image is mentioned like that, it refers to a culture. It doesn't mean the physical world, the globe, but a world is the world of one's culture. So when the famous world destruction fantasies get going, the fear of world destruction and the cataclysmic nightmarish pictures of how the world is going to be destroyed, it refers to that inner culture form. Oddly enough, both the self-image and the world image take the form of a mandala, the quadrated or quadriform world, a round world, squared maybe, emphasizing a center, and of four continents, four colors, four races. That's, I think, because the self-image and the world image move together. When the self-image is going through death, the world image is going through the world destruction phase. And when the self-image is going through the rebirth, the world image is going through world regeneration. So these two things belong to each other. And I think that's why the new self amounts also to a calling, a vocation. What one's going to do in the world. Now, it's very different with the visionaries who go into a prophetic calling. The ingredients are the same, but this is something that is surprisingly similar. As you know, probably during the recent decades, since World War II, cultural anthropologists have done a great deal of studies of crisis cults, as Western Labau would call them, or revitalization movements, as A.F.C. Wallace describes them. These are movements in times when the culture is going through such a profound change that it gets disorganized. Meanings go out of everything, and in that confusion and anxiety, a whole set of circumstances get going that have a program very much like this. There's a time of general disturbance when the people are losing the sense of meaningfulness. The traditional answers are no longer applicable to questions, and the lifestyle is no longer what's there because of a new economy or a new governing power somehow. And in these changing circumstances, all the old traditional forms cannot hold up. And like the Native American, for instance, there's great distress, a sense of really being quite lost, and the meaning of what it is to be a man or to be a woman is just not any longer clear the way it had been. Now, in these, the messianic calling comes up in prophets during times like this, have to be taken the opposite way, as a true calling, a true mission to reform one's society, and to find ways ahead and steer the energies, govern the energies into new pathways. And an energetic leadership is needed from this prophet. That messianic program, then, is not a subjective thing like this, but a potential new myth and ritual form and a new program for organizing the society that will be received. If it's on target, the people will receive it. For the reason, that's already what's in their minds. The collective unconscious is doing the work. It's not the individual prophet who does the work, it's the psyche. And the psyche is much the same, running through the populace. Sensitive souls are the ones who get most anxious, most upset, and they dream dreams and they have visions. The ones who are specially called and specially gifted have the dream, the vision. And if it's really on target, really corresponds to what's going on in the collective psyche, it's received by the people. F.C. Wallace has a very good description of this sequence of events. It's he puts it in terms of five main phases, which I'll just sketch briefly. There's first the steady state. There are little changes going on from decade to decade, minor changes. Culture keeps modifying itself and increasing its skills. Always an equilibrium. then when this impact comes in, say the white impact on the South Sea Islands or the white impact on our continent here or in Africa, then there's a period of increased individual stress, and people are disillusioned, they're disorganized, they're quite aware that their equilibrium breaks down, and there's puzzlement, anxiety. That's quickly followed by a period of cultural distortion, as Wallace calls it, the take to drugs and alcohol, and it might breach the mores in various ways, especially with violence, and the culture begins to disassemble itself, so to speak. Then, with a prophet, somebody who has the vision and the charisma, he says the thing that people are waiting to hear, and that is expressed as the new myth. And it brings a revitalization. The people can gather around this, reorganize around it, and it has a whole career of its own, organizing itself, communicating this new message, and transforming the culture and letting it settle into a routine form. And what follows then is a new steady state. A man named Lantinari has written about this a good deal. Very interesting material. And Western Labar too. And what's described there are sounds very much like this. The whole society sees itself going back to the original golden age of the beginnings. That's what's promised by their leader. And there are images of tremendous cataclysms and upheavals and a kind of apocalyptic vision of the known world coming to an end, an abrupt finish. The dead rise, the ancestors come back and around, and the social order is reversed. Things are topsy-turvy. Then there are images of this world regeneration after the cataclysm and a new golden age, a second golden age of plenty and abundance and joy and well-being. The messianic figure is interpreted customarily as a kind of reincarnation of the first culture hero. So he's the leader, it's sometimes a king, sometimes a prophet, sometimes a healer. But at least at the focus of all the change in the culture. And with this, the cosmic conflict plays its part, often the natives against the white people, Africa and this continent, India. The white impact is a great stimulus to this kind of pattern, rather deadly impact. And it doesn't always go well. The ones who go well are the ones who have a prophet and can reestablish their own culture over against the white impact. That's what happened with the Seneca, an Iroquois tribe, a man named Handsome Lake, became their prophet. It was a sort of slum society in the 18th century, just going downhill and disorganized and nothing happening. And very dispirited, a lot of alcoholism, a lot of witchcraft, and a very pathetic group of people. Handsome Lake was one who was grieving over a loss in the family and became ill. During his illness, he recited some sacred songs in a way that should not have been done in public. He had intense guilt, and in all this feeling of illness and depression and self-blame, he went into a coma. And his whole body became cold, first the limbs and then the trunk. Finally, just one hot spot left right here. And everybody thought he was dying. But he didn't. He rallied. And he rallied because during this coma, he'd been off traveling around the heavens. And the hot spot then, when he came back from his sky journey, began to spread and his limbs became warm and he revived. Where he'd been was on the Milky Way, walking along that path, and the path to the left was the way to the destroyer, and the way to the right, the punisher rather, to the right was where you meet the Creator. And when he took that path, he was given instructions what to do when he came back to his people. He should be a healer, reorganize the people, have a new government, and stamp out witchcraft, and essentially give the people a new invigoration. So he did that. But one more thing that he saw out there when he was still out in space was that there was a red or yellow spot up in the sky, fire, spots of fire. And these were extremely threatening because if they were allowed to have their way, they would destroy the entire populace and the world with what's called the Great Sickness. And there was another white light in a different part of the sky which held those at bay, so they were just in balance. And he was told, now go the way of the white light and you'll be safe. You must heal the people. So that's a rather typical experience of many, many like that, that I could spend the whole evening narrating. One rather delightful one is of a Native American named Wadzawab, who was a Paiute in the California border near Nevada. And he was out on the mountainside and having a vision and saw the whole world open up. It's a tremendous cataclysm. The thing tears apart and opens up this chasm that the whole known world falls into that chasm. Stays there 3 days. And on the fourth day, the world is regenerated. It's a beautiful new paradise. The ancestors come back and live among the present-day people. And the Great Spirit is with them. And the white man is nowhere to be found. That began the ghost dance, which you've probably heard about. This was 100 years ago. The ghost dance swept the country after these visions from coast to coast. And the Native Americans had this hope that maybe if they went with these visions, that this would be their salvation. So it was a real reinvigoration of the people for quite a time. Didn't quite work. Now, this entire kind of visionary process of such people is the inverse of what I was saying about the psychotic individual. These people are pretty crazy when they're in their vision. Some of them are not just comatose, they're really out there in left field. But they're having meaningful visions and they know what to do with them when they come back, like Black Elk, for instance. It took him a few years to find out, but eventually it did. These are not to be taken merely at the symbolic level, the subjective level, but these people are called to do work in the world, in the society. And the self-image, in that case, is the figure of the prophet himself personifying the culture. There are many of these prophets who have an out-of-body experience and see their body lying on the ground, either in death or deathly ill. And that is an image of the culture, a symbol of where the culture is. So they're personifying it. And then their own self-renewal is at the same time representing the renewal of the culture. The emphasis is always what it's going to do for the people. It's to be translated into action and to be given to the people as new myth and ritual forms. And then the world image in that case is no longer an image just of the subjective culture, but it's the image of the actual culture itself, the people. And the new myth and ritual, as I say, provides new guidelines for living in that world in the new conditions. Still unfamiliar. So both these things, they're both healing, psychotic episode, the personal one, self-healing, self-reorganizing. And on the cultural level, healing again and self-organizing, self-reorganizing, as if the culture itself were an organism. I think that's the important point. That it has to go through what the individual goes through. Wallace has suggested that maybe the time of the urban revolution, the Bronze Age, 5,000 years ago, much the same thing might have happened. It's not recorded in history, unfortunately, but the changes were very swift, and the new myth and ritual form in Egypt was almost done at the stroke of a hand of the new pharaoh, the first pharaoh. Frankfurt, who taught in Chicago, felt that the first pharaoh, Namer, was probably a genius, that he somehow could put the ingredients of the old local mythologies into a new form and conceive of this united Egypt, of Upper and Lower Egypt. Everything is twofold right through the entire kingdom. All the offices, all the agencies, all the structures, all the myth is twofold. And it's a beautiful system of integrating the stud in a totally new way, first time in the world, in that particular fashion. Quite obviously seemed to come out of as new guidelines for living in that world in the new conditions. Still unfamiliar. So both these things, they're both healing, psychotic episode, the personal one, self-healing, self-reorganizing, and on the cultural level, healing again, and self-organizing, self-reorganizing, as if the culture itself were an organism. I think that's the important point. That it has to go through what the individual goes through. Wallace has suggested that maybe the time of the urban revolution, the Bronze Age, 5,000 years ago, much the same thing might have happened. It's not recorded in history, unfortunately, but the changes were very swift, and the new myth and ritual form in Egypt was almost done at the stroke of a hand of the new pharaoh, the first pharaoh. Frankfurt, who taught in Chicago, felt that the first pharaoh, Namer, was probably a genius, that he somehow could put the ingredients of the old local mythologies into a new form and conceive of this united Egypt, of Upper and Lower Egypt. Everything is twofold right through the entire kingdom. All the offices, all the agencies, all the structures, all the myth is twofold. And it's a beautiful system of integrating the stud in a totally new way, first time in the world, in that particular fashion. Quite obviously seemed to come out of somebody's head, so to speak, and came out of visions of this kind in mythological form. It's too bad we don't know about Mesopotamia. That seemed to be a little more gradual, and yet there was abrupt changes also there. And it looks as though some of their sacral kings indeed were visionaries. That was part of their magic. In China, most certainly it was that way. The Son of Heaven was a kind of shaman, and he had special psychic powers and was ruler as well. So it looks as though visionaries did a lot of the work of instituting those cultures at that very creative period of time. So, come now to the our time, end of the second millennium, and this is approaching the question I want to ask. Very complicated question. Probably the longest question I've ever asked, I think. But here it is. Obviously, we're at such a turning point at the end of this millennium, end of this century. Signs and symptoms of it are perfectly obvious, in this framework particularly, of a culture that's kind of losing it. It's losing the meaningfulness of its values, the effectiveness of its values, and its beliefs. And there's no unanimity, and everybody's out for himself. And not only that, but the usual signs and symptoms, drugs, violence, alcohol, the mores all crumbling. It's a pretty clear picture in this kind of sequence that we're speaking of. A man named Sorokin is well worth reading. He taught at Harvard 50 years ago and wrote Crisis of Our Age, Man, Society, and Calamity, two very readable books and very, very instructive. And his formulation was that we're at the other pole from, let's say, the medieval culture, early medieval culture, where everything was unified. There was unified faith, there was one God, one belief, one practice of that. The government was pyramidal, the whole feudal system kind of organize the culture in this very united, integrated kind of way. We wouldn't like it, but anyway, it's very impressive as a structure culturally. And that's what he calls an ideational culture, centered on the supersensory, super-rational, supra-rational, those things that are directed from heaven, essentially. You go through the Renaissance period, which tried to hold two poles together. They were beginning to discover the ordinary world, the sensory world, and still trying to hold on to the old beliefs from the medieval time. So that's idealistic for a couple of centuries, 14th, 15th century. And then, in the last 500 years, this increasing materialism and being engrossed with the sensory world and sensory values, pleasure, the chief dynamic, gain, the chief dynamic also, increasingly. And the institutions begin to crumble one by one. And he had it pretty clear. He wrote these things during the Nazi World War II era. Pretty clearly had it that we're in the last years of that whole phase of what he called sensate culture. So at the end of this century would be the time that that would suddenly cease to work, essentially, that the economics don't work. And as we can see already, he couldn't see it then. We can see the planet's getting used up and the economy isn't quite working. And in various ways, the needed answers are not coming up with the important questions. So he's quite clear that we are at that end point at present. Very stimulating reading. What we would expect then would be an activation of the collective unconscious at such a time. And of course, the fact that we reach to the Far East, to India and China, is part of that. Take an interest in Jung and the unconscious and the spiritual life and myth. And we're beginning to reach into that to see if we can come up with a new orientation. It's a time for visionaries to appear, one would think. And just there we have a stumbling block, as you know, with our psychiatric preoccupation with stamping out irrationality. A visionary better be very quiet, do it under, right under his pseudonym, and never go see a doctor. And how do you protect visionary experience in a time like this? You talk to both psychiatrists about this and say, nonsense, it's disorder, it's insanity. These are pathological conditions, so medicate them. Put them in undercover. That's a self-evident answer to the, let's say, 95% of psychiatrists nowadays. So one thing we need, one thing I talked about in Baltimore last month, is how to differentiate these people right at the beginning. So first episode, somebody comes in, brought in by the friends, or even by the police maybe, and very crazy. And how do you know? Is this man going to become like the old dementia praecox, you know, just downhill into insanity? That's officially what's called schizophrenia now. At the end of 6 months, they can be called that. Or is it this kind of person who goes through a renewal process in the right conditions? That means a special place for that. You can't do it in hospitals. It doesn't work. So they need a different kind of handling, a take off in a different direction than the truly schizophrenic ones. And then the true visionaries, the prophetic kind, these would be gifted poets, artists, people in the music world, the rock world, of course. We had lots of prophets there. In the 60s, we had prophets on every street corner in the Haight-Ashbury, because you knew. And some of them very gifted. Some really knew how to speak the word. And some of the rock stars were psychotic along the way to becoming prophetic musicians, so to speak. Several of them. And very effective musicians afterwards. So they learn from their visions all these things to give us. So they're around, and they, in that case, should be steered away from any kind of facility. Even like Diabasis, I think they need to be sent to a retreat, Zen center maybe, some Buddhist retreat, or some Catholic retreat, somewhere where people be kind to them and be friendly and listen to them and let them do their thing, which they'll do very soon. I should mention that Diabasis, people got over being crazy within 2 or 3 days without medication. You know, it's surprising how easy it is to handle this if you have the right conditions. So, finally, it's just about the end of my time to talk, and I'll come up with a question. It took 60 minutes to ask, which is obvious to you now. Where do we expect the new myth and ritual to come from? If it's time for it now, and we need a new direction, I don't want to step on believers' toes here, those who have their belief in the Christian message, fine, but even that would have to be renovated, revitalized. So where does it come from? What's the criterion of a new real myth and ritual? Not science fiction, not Tolkien, you know, beautiful mythic stories, but what's really new, really expressing the great need of the time. How do you recognize it? How do you recognize what a real myth is? I think Joe Campbell had a very good way of putting it about real myth as against mythic fantasy. Real myth has one limb of the cosmos, the macrocosm. It's based on cosmic thinking. And another limb in the societal world, the world of human affairs, the mesocosm, which used to be the old kingdom, and the microcosm, that is the inner life of the psyche. If it addresses those three things, that's real myth. And then the fourth dimension of this would be the ultimate experience of the divine directly, without myth. As you would have in Buddhism, for instance. Do we even want to look for great myth makers? You know, cult leaders and visionaries becoming famous, people with huge followings out in tents in the countryside. It doesn't sound like what we're after to me. Do we have great new founders of new crisis cults coming up? I think there's a tremendous impatience and leery sort of hesitant feeling about cults nowadays since Nazism and since Jonestown, and maybe some of the gurus that have been operated nearby. It doesn't sit well. It doesn't seem to be the kind of thing out of which answers would come for modern people. And so where does it come from? What form does it take? I think the Jungian expectation was it's everybody's business. You know, we all do our own work back home. And do it inwardly. I think if there's a fault in that, it's that we all get so individual we forget about society, often. We don't read the paper, and we don't vote very well, and keep sending money into ecological concerns. You know, all the participation in making the world go right is something that needs a great deal of motivation. And the typical Jungian motivation, it seems to be, is quite inward. It's quite enough to save our own souls. So I don't agree with that. I think there has to be something that does bring people together in a new cultural form. And it isn't going to happen just by politics or just by gradual, slow rethinking everything. It doesn't happen that way. So if it is going to be everyone finding their own myth and finding their own belief and having their own direct experience with the archetypal world, is it too disparate? Is it too dispersive? Is that too much like what Sorokin would find is the trouble with the modern era? It's democratic, but it becomes very soon that everybody has a different set of expectations, a different kind of motivation, operate by quite different values, and what holds it together, what makes it cohere, begins to get too loose. There's a thing I've left out of the account, which is, I'm just going to take a couple more minutes. Through this whole evolution of kingship, individuality was right at the core of it. You don't read this in the histories or the studies of that myth and ritual, but it is pointed out each time in each one of these cultures that the central figure, the one who personified the cosmic center, was sacral king, but he was a great individual, the only great individual. It was a unique and a ceremonial thing, apparently, at first. Very soon after that, it was dispersed out into the aristocracy, and in Egypt, for instance, where only the pharaoh could become an Osiris and go into the next life. The aristocracy could buy that funeral rite and be buried and expect the same outcome as the pharaoh. And after a few more centuries, it trickled on down and out to the populace. Anybody who was rich enough, prestigious enough, could have some of that. Individuality became something to strive for. The fault being that as it did that, it almost destroyed, well, it did destroy the Egyptian culture for a while. Not permanently, but it wrecked it. Same in China, same thing. The unique man was the son of heaven at the center. And then the nobility began to take on some of those prerogatives and some of that image, and they fought each other and all wanted to be powerful, went against the other. The whole thing became a shambles. The people were suffering terribly. At the time that Confucius appeared on the scene with his vision of a new kind of way of ruling and governing. So what happens right at that point where individuality becomes extremely chaotic and dangerous? Someone like Confucius comes up with the proposition, look, what makes a society hold together is, friend, that is human-heartedness. Every man treats every man like a brother. The whole human community is like a family. The king is like a head of that family. And people belong to each other. And friend means a real nobility of heart where there's compassion and caring. So he spoke of what it is to govern well. You love the people. Buddha lived exactly the same time way over across the mountains and with the same thing. How do you govern? Compassion is the thing that makes it work. In a time when India was beginning to get quite disorganized. So there's another dynamic that is not in these stories I've told you about prophetic cults and revitalization movements. Those are a preliterate level on most of those descriptions. And if you were to have that in a sophisticated culture like ours, it's going to be different. Maybe the essential message will not be getting free of an oppressor, but finding the way into this way of a compassionate living together and living in relationship. I'm just going to close with a statement of what that kind of China looked like when it was most unified, Sorokin's ideational culture, where it's unified, it's together, everything works, and it's in harmony. And he says, if a superior, that is a governor, loved propriety, the people will not dare not to be reverent. If he loved righteousness, the people will not dare not to submit to his example. If he loved good faith, the people will not dare not to be sincere. Now, when things obtain, the people from all quarters, these things obtain, the people from all quarters will come to him, bearing their children on their backs. That's about as integrated a picture of a society as you could get. And he captures it in a little image. He who exercises government by means of his virtue may be compared to the North Pole star, which keeps its place and all the stars turn to it. Now, I think that's at one pole, this pole, I guess, it's supreme order. The time that Joel, the prophet, wrote in the Bible, it was about the 4th or 5th century B.C., where apocalyptic visions were the current thing. They were expecting the whole world to go into darkness very quickly. And you probably have heard this many times, but I'll remind you of it, that the Lord says, I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream dreams, your young men shall see visions. And also upon the servants and the handmaids in those days will I pour out my spirit. That means it really is everybody's business. It's a time that did not happen. It was not a prophecy of what was going to happen in the next centuries of Israel. But perhaps it takes that long to get to it. So I hope we can discuss some of this and answer some of that question when we come back after a little interruption. Thank you. I hope there are a lot of questions because there's a lot to discuss about all this. I might just say that one question did come up in the interval, and it's one I should have addressed myself to, I think, while I was talking. I always have a tendency to make it sound too rosy and too much like a paradise, everybody getting well and going home early and everything. I do that because I've seen this favorable side, which is a side you rarely do see in the profession otherwise, so that's why I emphasize it so much. What impressed me was that, as I say, people who come out of their chaotic state, the fragmented state, within 2 or 3 days become quite coherent. So at Diabasis, I'd come in and have supper with everybody, and I'd look around the table, and there'd be some new faces. I wouldn't know whether it was a new client who'd been there 2 or 3 days, or whether it was a new staff member. It was that close. Now, it doesn't mean everybody who goes through this goes out and has no recidivism, no return to hospital. One thing that I didn't mention was we had an experimental program before Diabasis, an NIMH-supported AGNU project, which was a large-scale, very scientific, double-blind experiment to see who did well and who did badly with medication, who did well without medication. And there were 4 boxes, you know, with and without, and about 120 cases in all, some of whom dropped out, 81 were followed up, and of those, the ones who did best were the ones without medication. Not only that, but the ones who are on medication in the hospital and after had a recidivism rate of 73%. That was about roughly national average for a state hospital. The ones without medication in hospital and after, or 3-year follow-up, 8% recidivism. Now that's, nobody wanted to hear that. So it really didn't get a fair hearing. So that was the difference. That was very scientifically done. They're false in the protocols, you know, the dropouts and things like that mean that the figures are not very solid, but still, it speaks for itself even so. So there is that about going the non-medicated way, that people, in fact, fare better statistically. At Diabasis, we were just going to do follow-ups when we wound up at the end of the second year. And that's when we began to hear we were getting chopped off quite abruptly from financing. And we didn't get a chance to do any follow-up. So, unfortunately, I don't have anything to report on that. Only that we had a 2-month ceiling on stay for the overnight 24-hour patients. 2 months, and by the end of the second month, they went out in great shape. A few exceptions. 80 cases in the second diabasis, 17 in the first, is about 100 cases altogether. There were a few who didn't do well, but most of them went out into a rejuvenated life, so to speak. Right. It's very hard to do because first breaks have a way of disappearing out into their community, the LMD or somebody takes care of them. And they get medicated very quickly. So we were getting the ones who heard about us and could come in quickly enough. We got a good many first day and second day. And we got some from hospitals. One was sent to us in a straitjacket, for instance, with all the men in white and tin helmets and everything. So it's remarkable how what looks like a dangerous patient in the hospital is a perfectly good human being once you treat him like a human being.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, were you able to hear that question? That there are some people who don't open up right away when you want to relate to them. There's quite a range of different kinds of people. And does that mean different outcomes? I think it's quite true. There's some who don't follow this pattern of getting clear in the second or third day. They have some anger to work out. Anger is a big factor in this whole thing. And we had a special room for that, a padded cell, as a matter of fact. But it was not isolation. It was not seclusion. It was to go in and beat some furniture to pieces, or cartons, beat them to pieces, get it out, or a punching bag. And communicating the anger, when you communicate the anger, it hastens things quite a bit. And then there are people who just take quite a little time to learn to trust the staff, you know, and they'll wait for the right person in the staff, and you never know who that's going to be. It's like transferences in general. They just strike where they will, you know. There is a variety of different kinds of responses. There's nothing routine about any of this except this kind of schedule, which, as I say, is only a rough grouping of ingredients of this process, that's all. Yeah, you were, I said. Yeah. Right. It is. I've tried to work with a few like that who just don't relate and spend time and week after week after week in my own practice too, I've done that. And they just don't. There's such a deep distrust. I don't know that it's incapacity. I think it's fear. And the anger is in all that too. I have not the least idea what the statistics would be if everybody were allowed to go through this thing under right conditions. We know a minimum of recoveries would be 15%, because it used to be that way before the days of medication, back when I was a resident. That's a minimum. Then I think maybe half or two-thirds of the patients who just get routinely medicated, sent off to hospital and all that, I think they could go through this quite fruitfully, probably, I think.
You're speaking a little bit as if the medication is the bugaboo that interferes with the healing process, rather than that it's the attendance on the material that helps the healing process. Because now I went through that stuff for 72 hours myself about 20 years ago, and that sense of ego dissolution is absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
There's just nothing quite like it.
Yeah.
And they gave me medication which did ease some of that pain.
Uh-huh.
And yet I was still able to go through the process and come out the other side of it carrying meaningful stuff with me, and which has persisted.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's the medication that necessarily is going to screw things up. It's only if all you do is medicate.
I think that's exactly the point.
That's what yeah. things up.
It's both.
Also, the thing that I worry about with my patients is that once they reintegrate, that's when I'm worried the most. I know they're going to reintegrate. Yeah. That doesn't scare me. But when they do, I'm afraid they're going to throw away.
Yeah.
Things that they've learned when they've gone through the psychotic process.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I work mostly in trying to keep people to remember that what they're seeing is important.
That's a very curious and very important phenomenon, the thing of putting the experience into the background and wanting to get away from it. And I agree. People, in the usual way of hospital treatment, when it's prolonged, the poetic and the visionary and have these wonderful visions when they're crazy, so to speak. And then as soon as they're out and in the world again, they become very prosaic and ordinary. All that flair for that special meaning in things is just gone. Gone underground, it's still there. So yeah, I think, do you have people do creative things with the content that had come up before? You know, sometimes people want to write about it or paint it or...
try to.
Yeah.
Usually yeah. It's a fight. They want to forget about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one thing that at Diabasis, even when the process was going on early, we found that happening, that they were so relieved to have the stuff subside second or third day that they'd want to be out in the street shopping and, you know, get back into the real world again. And when they saw what the real world was like in this frame of mind, they came back in and said, forget it, we'll leave that for later on. So we gave them plenty of room to make their own discovery about the real world. And they'd go out and they'd see what was going on, had that feeling of jangledness, you know. And we're very glad to, we had no locked doors at all. So the way we persuaded them to stay was just giving them a taste of that out there in an altered state of mind. Both of us. So the first comment is about initiation and what would happen, for instance, in childbirth. And I've seen not only little ones, but major ones with childbirth. You know, some women really go through quite a profound experience. If they're lucky, it's in dreams. If they're a little less lucky, they really have the visionary experience of it. And sometimes are called psychotic because of it. But that is distinctly, not even the firstborn either. Sometimes it's a second child that becomes the occasion for this kind of initiatory grand experience. A whole death and rebirth and discovering a kind of new world, a new relation to the world. And then the second... Yeah, when it comes back again and again. Minor visionary experiences that come around back again and again. That's one thing I meant to say about the big psychotic experience, too. I think there are these visionary things that will keep coming. And I think the reason they do is that there's work to do. You know, that they'll happen until it becomes... recognize and gets into life so it can be lived in some way. And with the full-blown psychosis, I think it's like that there can be a recurrence of the psychosis, not because they're sick again, but just because they didn't quite get finished. It really wasn't quite accomplished the first time.
perfectly valid second round to get it done, you know. Yeah. Speaking of, that reminds me of something, that if this is a self-healing process, but is thought of as pathology usually, where is the pathology? Obviously these people are in trouble. And the best way I've found of putting it is that this is a self-healing, very turbulent process, but nature's way. The pathology is in the state before the turmoil, so-called pre-psychotic personality, which may be too constricted or too timid, too untrusting of a relationship, too out of touch with the deep psyche, resistant maybe. All those are signs of trouble before the actual visionary state comes on, the psychosis comes on. And I think that's where the pathology is, if you want to call it pathology. We used to see people who, for one, I'll just pick a few items one by one. People who've taken hallucinogenics, so-called, psychedelics, sometimes were headed for a break like this and the drug would precipitate it. I think it would have come anyway in some of those cases, most of them. I don't think the drug will produce a psychosis. I mean, just trips it off, triggers it. And the other way, a good psychedelic experience, I think, does open up a lot of that inner world. Then the question is, are people going to follow it up with some real work? Or are they just going to rock around and enjoy it and do it again with their friends, you know, which was the usual story, unfortunately. We had a whole conference on psychedelics in Berkeley 2 months ago. Some of the old people were there, Tim O'Leary and everybody, all the gang, about 30 years older. And I think it was there was a lot of good information given out in that conference, but one of the things that was emphasized was the extremely long history in which these things have been used ritually. You know, this is Hama juice and the Soma juice and the Eleusinian mysteries, you know, used ergot. That it was in the wine, they didn't even know it, but that's what gave them their great experience. And Native Americans, the Native American church didn't discover peyote in the 60s. They've been doing it for hundreds of years, apparently. It's an old custom. So these are just history's experience of finding the inner life through altering the states of consciousness by plants, special plants, mushrooms. The Huichol Indians, for instance, in Mexico, done it for centuries also. So it's, I think there's no doubt that it's helpful for getting in touch with the inner life, and then, as I say, the follow-up really is the really important thing. In a society that doesn't have a way of following up, there is no regular way to keep in touch with that, like the Native American church. Right, yeah, even that. So the government is against all its states, I think, in general.
Yeah. I was intrigued by this notion of the wages and this kind of hierarchical model that it seems to me that within that level of development, that it takes a great deal of compression to paint something orderly like that.
Right.
It requires a lack of freedom.
Right.
And I think that my experience of what we're going through today is that there's a release of a repressed, and it's coming out in a lot of different ways.
Yeah. That's right at the heart of the question, isn't it? What is real order? When it's imposed order, it's people in power at the top, isn't it? Even the popes. But great emperors, Roi Soleil, you know, these wonderful pseudo-divine kings of later centuries. So the power motivation is... What am I doing? The power motivation, I think, is the essential thing there, that what I was saying about this much-desired individuality that became so much an ambition of aristocracy and then of lesser people did stir up a power drive that was very strong. And it tends to overlook the need of people and the concerns for people, and to set up a kind of abstract structure, just the way you're mentioning, this pyramidal way of doctrine and thought and creed. It's not great. I think Sorokin liked it. He did intense studies on art forms and literature and law and all aspects of life, so it's a very solid piece of sociological work. But his feeling was that there was a beautiful aesthetic unity in the medieval culture, and then that what's happened by the 20th century is just really downhill. So the question is, if you have another kind of order that isn't power-dominated, that would be something new and different, I guess. I think Tolstoy's Anarchy was supposed to be like that. Not disorder, but order that isn't centralized. And that would then depend on stirring up that eros, opposite of the power principle. The kind of spontaneous concern for people is just there because you live that way. If you had a benign society who were minded that way, you don't have to have chiefs and bosses and things. The Quakers have been like that. Quakers have been going for, what, 400 years now, I guess? 300. And they don't have any chiefs. They have elders sometimes who are just... they had a kind of like a good spokesman for the tenor of the meeting, you know, the sense of the meeting. But they don't dominate. And it's always nonviolent, and it's always very fair dealing. It's always a feeling of belonging to this community of friends. It's very self-organizing. So if that's a model for a good society, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania was set up that way by Quakers. And and it's always nonviolent, and it's always very fair dealing. It's always a feeling of belonging to this community of friends. It's very self-organizing. So if that's a model for a good society, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania was set up that way by Quakers, and it started to become different when other non-Quakers moved in and did things their way instead. So it didn't last very long. But that kind of question is right. But how do you get order in a society that isn't by way of dominance? And how is it that in Europe, in Eastern Europe, you have people pouring into the streets spontaneously, and no leaders, no chiefs, no bosses, no propagandizers, but they're not violent. Probably in this country it would be violent from the beginning, you know. But there's some sort of cultural way they have that is better rooted, better grounded. It's miraculous that as a manifestation of a spontaneous collective psychology is sort of wonderful. Yeah. It's very striking, isn't it, that the Dalai Lama, you know, when he had a dialogue with some of those prophets of the Hopi, found that they had the same prophecies. They corresponded. And then you have other spiritual movements that have decided that this is a time when these mysteries and the secrets should be revealed. There is a great deal of that kind of teaching among mystery cults. So, yeah, there's a general consensus that from that spiritual world, as well as from the world of active politics, that this is a time when the psyche is going to break out in the open in some way, and we have to prepare ourselves. And then the Native American way, it's... they live so much embedded in nature, don't they, in a way that we don't. We are an urban culture, fewer and fewer people live on the land now. They don't watch the seasons as mindfully as we used to. And can you take on the ways of a culture that is embedded in nature that way, feeling very much part of nature, both plant life and animal life and cosmic life, all those? Can you bring that into a white culture that's so urbanized, you know, they live on pavements and brick buildings and we're shut off from nature most of the time, except if we go hiking or something for brief excursions. So I'm doubtful about importing. I think even the impact from India, I think, is dubious, because when you take a meditative practice or a spiritual teaching and a spiritual method out of its cultural context and try to readapt it to this context, it obviously has not taken root. You know, it's inspired a lot of people, helped a lot of people, but it never lasts. And it makes you wonder if importing is going to be not the way, you know, that we have to, through the impact of some of those experiences, we generate our own new way that really would belong to us then. I think the analytic way is maybe the most desirable in some ways, because it moves slowly. You know, the psychotic thing is extremely rapid. 6 weeks is a very short time for all that much material to come up and be given expression and be scrutinized. It's very, very fast, highly energized. And then the other way, in an ordinary spiritual practice, you know, you're learning Kundalini and you take years, like Gopi Krishna, who took 20 years finally to get enlightened, and then he couldn't throw it off for a while. Very interesting account. The analytic way is sort of sped up by the intensity of the attention given to unconscious process, but on the other hand, slow enough so that it there's plenty of time to assimilate in between sessions and between dreams and paintings and things, to bring it into life, to accommodate it. I think the usual visionary experience is something that doesn't occur very often in analysis. It might, but I think we take the steam out of it a good deal by assimilating and scrutinizing and following an unconscious process quite methodically. Most of the impressive visionary states in everyday life, I think, on the part of writers and artists, people who've really gone over the edge into that visionary state and survived it and grown by it. Wordsworth did this when he was a young man, who wrote a poem about it, that he found himself in that other cosmic space and quite isolated with it, but was able to adapt it to his life and to find himself wiser because of it, even though other people are saying it looked crazy. Hermann Hesse also. There are a good many accounts of individuals who have these lesser visionary experiences and really, really make use of them creatively. Am I answering it? That it's no, I wouldn't. I think the analytic way is far better. Providing the relationship is intense, you know, the so-called transference, I think what it really means depends on your framework, but the transference strictly is the projective part of it. But the therapeutic relationship is a dynamic encounter. I think it needs a separate name than that. And it, that if that's got a lot of energy in it, something like a visionary state occurs because the psyche is very activated. The dreams become very colorful. And you dream 2, 3, or 4 times a night in full technicolor Panavision, you know. That's an activation of the psyche. I had something a little like that in Zurich when I was there because all the input was so powerful, and I was just coming back from China having a culture shock in reverse, you know, getting back to this culture, that my psyche was going full tilt for a couple of years. I think the trouble with the psychotic version of that is that it goes by so fast that you don't really get time to get it into life, to adapt it. You get a lot of insight. But after a couple of months of this sort of experience, you always have this feeling, this person has to go out and try it out now and live that, see if they can hold on to it, keep it alive. That instant visionary experience that, for instance, you get with Stan Grof's breathing thing, the holotropic breathing, that has a kind of ritual program to it. There's a whole expectation of what you're going to get into, and it happens. And people are changed by it. They really find their psyche opened up by this thing. But the trouble is, it's only during that particular workshop. And then you have to see if you can follow it up with somebody else afterward to keep it going. So it's a puzzle, I think, to know what to do with those brief visionary states to make sure that they do their work. Nowadays, are there any? The question is there any program now for people like this? We tried 3 times in the Bay Area during the 80s, and each time it didn't work out. For financial reasons. But part of the financial reason was that the profession was not being cooperative in referring cases very much. There's a wall of resistance out there. What we did was get different fundings. We had the San Francisco Foundation and we had a special place in the mental health system of the San Francisco County, and that gave us, those 2 things gave us enough money, plus the paying patients. Putting those 3 things together, it could be financed. And nowadays, it's hard. I've talked to foundations about this 15 years ago now, in 1975, and they were fed up with this whole thing about schizophrenia. They're given a lot of money in the 50s and 60s to it and said it didn't produce anything, and they are not giving to it anymore. The best is to find people who have sons or daughters who are psychotic and who have money. We got a landlord that way for diabetes. somebody whose son had been schizophrenic, and he was very concerned and gave us a building at a low rental. The wall of opposition to it, and the opposition holds the purse strings, you know, they're the consultants for foundations who want to know if this is a good prospect or not, and they go to the expert. The expert is very conservative and believes in medication and brain disorder. So the conviction in the profession is all this psychopathology is brain disorder, and it's supposedly corrected by medication. Most people know that isn't true, but that's the word often used. It's made amenable by medication. And that's such a solidly based belief system that what is physical, what's brain, and what's chemical, and all these substances in the brain, that if things are changed on that level, that must be primary. What's physical has to be primary. What's psychic is epiphenomenal. It's a secondary result from that. It's very sloppy thinking, but it's probably better thinking would be the two things move together, that the holistic approach would be that what's emotional and psychic and what's chemical and structural in the brain move in unison together. So the total organism is the thing going through the experience. And then there's always this interesting question, is there then any primary cause, or is it just everything moving together at the same time? But that wall of opposition is strong. In the 90s, it might loosen up, because it's hard to keep up the illusion that medication is curative, because everybody knows it isn't. Yeah. That does what? I think it's educated to people a great deal. They don't have a very good device to care for people, but they train people to do that sort of work, at least. And then it waits for... There are a lot of people out there who have gone through that training who wish there were a facility where they could work. So it's sort of blocked. The whole thing is blocked at that point. We do need new facilities. The Spiritual Emergency Network, SEN. Christina Grove set that up, and I've had a good deal of interaction with them, and it's worthwhile. But and they've got a very good new book on that. I don't know if that's out here, but the Stormy Search for the Self, it's called. In any culture form, there'll be certain archetypes that are prevalent and dynamic and motivating to the people. And some are just not around. They're simply not playing a part. And visionary states do what you suggest. I think they fetch up those things that have been left out. Neumann has written a very good thing about that, about the... Art and Archetypes. What's the title of that book? Does anybody know? Anyway, it's Neumann. Erich Neumann. Neumann. Well, not The Origins of History. There's another book on art, I think it is, that the creative psyche. Yeah, art and the creative unconscious. Yeah, that's it. And there he explains very well. There, a culture will light up certain archetypes and emphasize them, and then they fade with culture change, and others come up instead. And he doesn't talk about visionary states, but that the psyche will activate those others to compensate. Cultural differences are very striking in this. You know, you look at Chinese culture, for instance, which has such fun with dragons, and a hero in their myths and their legends will never kill a dragon. He'll go down and visit the Dragon King down below the waters, base of the river or the lake, and come away rich and marry the Dragon King's daughter, maybe. That's a very profound difference in culture from, say, the Teutonic culture, where Siegfried is out to slay the dragon, or Tristan does that, and the Tristan is older legend, of course, also. So dragon slaying is sort of a mark of the energetic culture-making hero. So why is the difference? Well, it's a difference in attitude to nature. In China, you don't bulldoze nature. You nurse it, cooperate with it, and learn its ways. You learn from nature, where in the West, there's this other vanquishing kind of attitude, you know. But it has a lot of consequences. When some of those archetypes are that different, it has many, many consequences in the psychology of the people. Yeah, yeah. Whether medication will slow down or accent some of these phases. There's a kind of Jungian principle involved in that, that you don't manipulate the psyche. You know that you follow its lead and you learn what it's striving toward. And if it's going after something that's unfavorable, you get conscious of it. But to do things to the psyche, Jung is always very reluctant to do anything to the psyche. And I must say, I had that feeling too. I wouldn't want to give psychedelics to psychotic people to see if you can hasten it up, for instance. People do. People have done it. I think we'll have to call it. It's 10 o'clock, and I'd appreciate very much your suffering.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.